accession number 18269, reel 5.
Jim Dow, reel 5.
Right.
You were just telling me about having contracted this fever.
That's right, and I think I finished up with the phrase, as far as I was concerned, that was the end of the Syria campaign.
What happened to you next?
Well, I don't remember anything very much for the next few days, naturally. But several of us were carted off by ambulance, went back down into Palestine. But about all I can remember of that was we stayed overnight in a monastery or convent in Nazareth. And all I can recollect of that was that it was so quiet, peaceful, cool, and it's a pleasure to hear the convent or monastery bells ringing for evening vespers. And then just a short call from the muezzin from some local minaret. The only other aspect of the journey I can remember was that the following day we were all offloaded off ambulances and laid out in rows on the dockside railway station in Haifa Harbour. And the one thing that sticks in my mind then was that amongst local people who were probably doing local welfare work and perhaps local Red Cross and all that sort of thing. Among those people was one beautiful young lady with fair hair in a sky blue dress, very simple blue, sky blue dress. But unfortunately, she didn't come near us because she'd apparently been allocated to. Because she could speak Greek, she'd been allocated to look after some Greek officers. From there, I can remember nothing more except finding myself in what I think was the 15th Scottish Hospital, near Sarafand, which is about 4 miles southeast of Tel Aviv. I think I was there for about 6 or 7 weeks with this fever coming on in intervals. I can't remember how many times it occurred. The one thing I can remember very forcibly was that apparently the only cure at the time was an injection of arsenic, of all things. And the doctor used a syringe to push this arsenic into my left thigh. And whether it was the chemical itself or whether the needle struck a main nerve, but for about the next 2 days, it felt like a red-hot poker down the full length of my left leg, which didn't help my feelings very much. The doctor did say that he couldn't give me any more arsenic because he'd kill me if he did. However, after about 6 or 7 weeks, I was passed on to a convalescent home on the coast near a place called Nathania. And there, I think I must have been there for a month or 5 weeks. But I don't think the fever ever came back there. So it was just a rather lazy holiday, but certainly needed a rest to pick up energy and so on. While I was there, one day on the beach, I found a broken open plywood crate with a couple of four-gallon petrol cans, more or less, still tied in it. And these were exactly the same things which had been throwing overboard from the Glen Roy. The woodwork was all burnt and scorched. So I think it was really an aftermath of the Glen Roy episode. The grocery picked up health and so on and so forth. And I did two trips to Jerusalem. And of course, there were no tourists around. And so I was able to go and see all the Christian sites. One might say almost on my own, there's nobody else about. At that time I did have a small camera, and so I was able to take a few photographs. I think this would have been during August and September, and I think about the end of October 1941, I did go back to the infantry base depot at Geneva on the Great Salt Lake, part of the Suez Canal. And I can't remember doing anything very much there for 2 or 3 weeks. but ultimately, sometime at the end of November, I was shipped forward to a transit camp outside Alexandria, and was due to go to Tobruk, where the battalion had been since August. But would you believe it, I went down with amoebic dysentery just before being shipped forward, and spent the next week in a military hospital in Alexandria. There was nothing very remarkable about that, except that at the time the rumour was going round that the battleship Barham had been either badly damaged or sunk. But nobody seemed to know. I think I must have stayed at that transit camp for a week or two, awaiting the next delivery service by a destroyer up to Tobruk. But just about the time we were due to go, the orders were cancelled, and they apparently didn't want any more reserves delivered to Tobruk. and so I found myself back again in the infantry depot at Geneva. The next interesting thing was that on Christmas Eve, a whole assortment of troops from all sources were gathered together, and we again went up to somewhere near this same transit camp in Alexandria, and we found ourselves put in charge of guard duties on a train which was taking German prisoners of war to a prisoner of war camp south of Cairo.
What impression did the Germans make on you?
I didn't see the other ranks, but I found myself nominally in charge of a group of about 30 German officers. They were all, it seemed to me, in about middle 20s, most of them fair-haired, and they looked and behaved like perfectly decent types. I think there were about 300 German other ranks in addition to 30 officers. When we got to Cairo main station, which is a terminal, the train was, of course, emptied into the station, and I definitely was found myself in charge and had to march this squad of German officers out into the open square or forecourt. They were very smart, very crisp drill, and really quite impressive, no doubt. They were putting on the best show they could for the benefit of the Egyptians, much to say, well, we've been caught, but we aren't finished by any means. But the thing that rather annoyed me, and probably a lot of other people too, was there were a lot of headquarters staff there, red-capped generals and colonels, and they kept on messing around. They couldn't seem to make up their minds whether they wanted the troops to be marched right through Cairo, either in columns of threes or fours or fives, and kept chopping and changing from one to the other. Very fortunately, I could at least count up to 10 in German, and these German officers seemed to understand precisely what was going on, and they shifted themselves from column of threes to fours and fives and popped back again without any trouble whatsoever. Anyway, when they did get that finally sorted out, and we had to march off, these German officers stepped it out at a cracking pace. How I managed to keep in front of them and my short stature and short legs, I just don't know. But ultimately, I think things must have slowed up, because after that, we had no problems, just marched through the crowded streets in central Cairo. We went to another station at the other southern edge of Cairo and put them all on another train and went to a prisoner of war camp. I think it was some 10 or 12 miles south of Cairo. Right. By this time, of course, it was quite dark. And as we moved away to go back to Geneva, I remember seeing the German prisoners in the camp under the floodlights, and they had got a song master, as you might say, standing up on a soapbox, and they were all singing carols, including Silent Night. And that itself seemed to be quite a moving moment. Well, we went back to Cairo and travelled back overnight by train, and so we got back into Geneva camp at the crack of dawn on Christmas Day. I think about a month later, the Queen's Battalion, having taken part in the breakout from Tobruk, were in a rest camp at a place called Kassassin on the Sweetwater Canal, quite close to El Tahag, where I first joined the battalion. Many of the troops were still on leave. But the majority were just about back from their leaves, and we could try to reorganise. When we suddenly got orders apparently, we didn't know where we were going to start with, of course, but apparently the orders were to go back to Syria to the precise situation where we'd been fighting the Vichy French. The battalion duly departed, and only to find 3 feet of snow in the area when they arrived. I happened to be detailed as part of the rear party for clearing up the camp, and so were the quartermaster. I was lucky enough to be able to go back into Cairo for 48 hours.
Why did you consider that good fortune?
Well, one didn't get much leave at all in those days, and I mean, just to get a bath was quite something. And of course, you saw a little bit of civilian life still, because in Cairo everything seemed to be perfectly normal. All hotels provided meals, etc., etc., and the cinemas, and of course all the drinking dens and that sort of thing. Not that I ever made much use of any of those. Well, after 48 hours in Cairo, the rear party had to set out for Syria, and we went by road, and the first night we just slept on the ground in the middle of the Sinai Desert. And one thing that always intrigued me was that it was clear starlight night, rather chilly, this being February, and I noticed that away to the west there seemed to be a misty pillar of white light in the sky. I've often wondered whether that was the pillar of light which guided the Israelites in the desert according to the Bible. I sometimes wonder whether it's something to do actually with the reflection of the westerly setting sun shining on the full length of the Mediterranean Sea and in some way being reflected upwards into the atmosphere. That, of course, is purely personal theory. The next day we drove through Beersheba and right through the length of Palestine. We could see the Sea of Galilee from the high land before we actually got down to the Sea of Galilee. And from that high point, one could see Mount Hermon in the distance, completely covered in snow. On the other hand, the very rocky territory above the Sea of Galilee was all a rather dull brown, but I do remember seeing what must have been a wild anemone in bright red. When the rear party reached the area in Syria where we'd been fighting, Most of the snow, fortunately, had melted away. And then we were put on the task of trying to dig in on hillsides to create what you might call isolated field fortresses with a purpose of holding up the Germans should they advance from northern Syria. this work was practically impossible to carry out. Somebody had marked out slit trenches and other defensive positions, but we found that the soil, if there was any, it was mostly stones and rocks, but anyway, the whole lot was frozen for at least a foot down. And so the entrenching tools and pickaxes we had were really quite useless and got blunt after about an hour's use. However, very shortly after that, we had orders to move back to Egypt, as usual. We didn't know where or why. But when we arrived there, we found ourselves in Suez and were put aboard a North Atlantic liner called the New Amsterdam.
This is the whole battalion?
That's the whole battalion, yes.
So this is well into 42 now?
Yes, this was the, might even have been March 1942. Early March. All I can remember the New Amsterdam was that we had a large cabin with white leather padded walls in which there were about four double bunks, temporary wooden bunks, and we were told this was part of Queen Wilhelmina's honeymoon suite. Whether that was true or not, I can't say. The only other thing I remember the New Amsterdam was that for the first time in my life, from the barman, I'd heard of the drink Singapore Gin Sling. However, we just set off down the Red Sea and out into the Indian Ocean, and when we'd been going for about a day, the ship, in the middle of the day, clear sky, calm sea, and brilliant sunshine, the ship suddenly did an about turn, so sudden that the ship itself tilted over as it turned. This, of course, a complete mystery, but we suppose that it must be Japanese submarines or something in the area, because we were unescorted. So we went back and stayed and anchored off Aden for about 3 days. Ultimately, we set off again without any further alarms or excursions, and next we saw land turned out to be Colombo Harbour, where we went ashore straight away, and we all piled into the battalion transport to move off to some camp in near Colombo itself. In the course of the drive through the centre of Colombo, the convoy was stopped, and apparently the local general in charge, who I think was General Pownall, who'd just been pushed out of Singapore, stopped the convoy and insisted on the troops marching. This rather upset a lot of people, I think, because we felt that we're so used to doing things quickly, in the quickest possible manner in North Africa. And I think the general feeling was, oh, blow these people, they just don't seem to know there's a war on. However, we set off marching through Colombo. I remember noticing that a very heavy grey leaden sky, and it looks as though we're going to get drenched by a tropical thunderstorm any minute. But in fact, nothing happened. The next day, my recollection is that we were shown the foreshore near the Goldface Hotel, which is right on the shore, and there's a low sea wall. There's a vast green expanse outside the Goldface Hotel, and then a low sea wall, perhaps 6 or 7 feet high, and we were shown on the beach at the bottom of this wall a number of concrete pillboxes, quite small ones. As an infantryman, I didn't like the look of these things at all, because it looked like being death traps, because there was no means of getting over this wall, and even if one had, one would have had to race across this vast open space, and in the event of an invasion, I think it would have been a case of staying in these pillboxes to the last man in the last round, and that was would have been the end of war for the unfortunate occupants. However, fortunately, and to my relief, within a day or two, we moved up to a place called Habarame, in what would have been called Northeastern Province, I suppose. Somewhere about halfway between Kandy and Trincomalee, or Trincomalee, as some people call it. There was nothing here except a public works department bungalow, but two roads did cross, and the single track railway also happened to be close at hand. Although there was nothing there in the way of buildings, at least it was a minor communications centre.